It's time for Forward Nation Radio. Now here he is, the host of Forward Nation Radio, David Leventhal.
Welcome to Forward Nation Radio, March 15th, 2017. Thank you for joining us. On today's show, a little bit on the news, and then we'll be following up and expanding on some of our earlier discussions of Starve the Beast, of states' rights or federalism, and finally we'll be talking about whether America should get to keep calling itself a democracy. But first, I want to start off with a question. I guess it'll be a rhetorical question, since I'm sitting in a box and I'm not live and I can't hear your answer anyway. Who is it who does its job despite rain or snow or heat or gloom of night? If you said the U.S. Post Office, you'd be right. That's the Post Office motto, as I'm sure you all, basically all of you, knew. At this point in time, however, that could apply to a whole lot of different companies. Given the great blizzard that many of us have just gone through, there are a lot of companies and a lot of people being tested at how they can fight through miserable circumstances. We hope that everybody is doing well, and we hope that you are getting the support that you need from your government. More on that in a moment. I'd also just like to give a shout out here for Fox News, which is also a very good answer to that question. Fox News spreading its propaganda 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. They are most like the Post Office in the fact that, like the Post Office, most of what they're delivering to us is junk that we really don't want anyway. Anyway, back to the blizzard of March 2017. And what maybe some of us might want to take away from this. I hope that you've done well. I hope that your streets were plowed, that you were kept safe, that if need be, your government was there to respond to any emergencies that arose. In other words, we once again learned the importance of a functioning government, both on the local and national level. As we go through storms like this, and given climate change, keep that quiet. Given climate change, storms like this are going to be far more frequent in the future. We understand the necessary role of, for instance, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. We have a few minutes, those of us who are old enough to do so, are able to reflect upon the Federal Emergency Management Agency under President Boy George and how it fumbled while a U.S. city was inundated and lost, Hurricane Katrina and New Orleans. We are reminded of the fact that President Bush at the time gave a big shout out, congratulations, the famous line, heck of a job, Brownie, he said to his head of FEMA, Michael Brown, a man who was utterly unqualified for his post. His prior job had been as president of the Arabian Horse Show Association. No experience whatsoever in disaster management, so no surprise to many people that when Hurricane Katrina came, he was completely unprepared to respond. Just a few days after the President of the United States gave him a shout-out, heck of a job, Brownie, words that will forever be immortalized in this country, Michael Brown had to be fired because it was so apparent what a lousy job he was doing. Just a few years ago, those of us on the East Coast, the New York area, got a chance to go through Hurricane Sandy. Superstorm Sandy, as it came to be known. One of the big differences between Superstorm Sandy and Hurricane Katrina were the reactions of the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Superstorm Sandy came during the Obama administration, an administration that cared about government, cared about putting qualified people into positions of power, and lo and behold, FEMA was universally acclaimed for the job that it did in helping with Hurricane Sandy. Those of you who've been suffering through blizzard of March 2017, I don't know if this has an official name yet, so I'm not using it. Those of you who suffered through blizzard of 2017 should at least be happy about one thing. The Republican overlords have not yet filled our government with the incompetence and the cronies that they will shortly be filling the government with. Two documents were released in making all the news of late. First, of course, a jobs report came out. Jobs report was very favorable. Unemployment inched even further down than what it had been. President Manchild, of course, is taking credit. Didn't see that one coming. This is the president who has been arguing for the entire campaign and afterwards. Well, he's still in campaign mode. But the president who's been arguing for the entire campaign and even after the campaign that the jobs report numbers were all fake and shouldn't be listened to. Well, big surprise. This jobs report number is actually not fake. This one we can trust. Let's ignore for a moment the fact that this was just a few weeks into the Trump presidency, and Trump really had nothing to say and nothing to do with this jobs report. But that's okay. He'll take credit for it anyway. The bigger thing here is, once again, the total bullshit coming out of this administration. Many of us have seen the clip of the presidential lie spokesperson, Sean Spicer, going in front of reporters to announce the jobs report and taking a question about, gee, the president has been talking about the jobs reports being fake numbers. Is he now saying that this one is not fake, that these numbers are reliable? And Sean Spicer gave a good laugh and said, yeah, we could trust that this job report, he believes in that this is accurate. Ha ha ha, it was a good laugh. It was pretty funny. In fact, so many of the reporters laughed. This is where we've come to in this country. The presidential administration, and for that matter, the Republican Party that he's part of, lies every time it opens its mouth. Every statement it issues is a lie. We're so used to it that it's now funny, that we take it for granted, we take it in stride. This is where we've gotten. This is pathetic. The guy should be fired. Every reporter in that room who laughed should be fired. This is not funny. If this were the Clinton administration, or for that matter, the Obama administration, Congress would already have voted articles of impeachment through for this lie and all the others that are coming out. I don't understand at this point in time how any news report contains the words, "the White House has said," or any variants on that statement. Why should anybody give a crap what the White House has said? Why should anybody care what Sean Spicer says? Why should anybody care what Kellyanne Conway says? Basically, unless you're planning on shooting a spitball, there's no reason to be at all concerned if she opens her mouth, or any of them opens their mouth. Because what's going to come is a lie. We're all Charlie Brown, and they're Lucy. How many times are they going to pick the football up before we say, I think you may not actually be abiding by your promise to keep the football down this time? How many times do you get lied to and keep coming back for more? This is already of great concern because it's starting to demonstrate, again, the capture of the press, of the White House press corps. Their jobs, their success is dependent upon having a good relationship with the White House. So you laugh at the funny jokes about the lies coming out of the White House. And maybe more distance needs to be kept. This puts us in mind, once again, of Stephen Colbert and how brilliant his speech was several years ago at the Correspondents' Club dinner, where he took them all to task for being nothing but basic scribes for a White House that lies. Standing next to then-President Boy George and talking about how facts no longer mattered. Reality, after all, has a well-known liberal bias. The second document that was released that's worth talking about, of course, and this just came out, is the excerpts of the Trump tax return. Wow, exciting and breaking news. Someone has leaked Trump's tax return. Well, it's still a little early in the process, and we don't know a whole hell of a lot, but there is a lot of speculation out there that the person who released the Trump tax return was Trump, or at least someone within his administration. It is a little too convenient. First of all, the tax return is 12 years old. Why that one? I also understand that it's marked on it that it's not an official document, that it's basically a client copy, which means it was not hacked from the IRS or any official source. It was not turned into the IRS or any official source. It's also the very little that was released most of it is actually pretty favorable to Trump. Of course, the newspapers are filled with the headlines that Donald Trump paid 25% in taxes that year. This, of course, comes on the heel of all the speculation prior to the election that Donald Trump has basically paid 0% in income taxes over the years leading up to the election. And yet, this comes out and says 25%. It seems a little convenient. The stuff that many of us are really curious about. None of that was included in this excerpt of the tax return. What ties he might have to Russia, or might have had 12 years ago, I don't believe any of that is in the tax return or the part that was released. Whether Donald Trump has ever contributed any money to a charity, I don't believe that that was in the report either, or the part of the tax return that was released. It is convenient the extent to which this seems to benefit Trump. Now, the one thing that people will analyze about that 25% that could actually reflect negatively on the Republican overlords is the fact that Donald Trump only paid that 25% in tax in income taxes because of the alternative minimum tax, something that Republicans have made clear that they would like to eliminate. And maybe we should be having a discussion about the importance of the alternative minimum tax because of how little Donald Trump would have been expected to pay on that tax return were it not for the alternative minimum tax. But given our previous discussion about the amount of bullshit coming out of the White House, the fact that this Trump tax return may have actually come from the White House makes perfect sense. By the way, not being an official copy, since it may have come from the White House, I wouldn't even place a whole lot of stock in the numbers being accurate. Most things coming out of the Trump administration are completely made up. Why wouldn't some of this be? More, of course, will come out on this one over time. But given the extent to which the Trump administration has demonstrated that they will lie to get whatever they want, it is at least interesting to think about where this tax return may have come from, this portion of a 12-year-old tax return may have come from. Well, also in the news, of course, has been the American Health Care Act. Yes, the Republican replacement for Obamacare is finally out there. Well, it's out there in an early form and is subject to change, so we're not going to, again, go into the details of the American Health Care Act, but there are a couple of things that I would like to focus on with respect to this bill. First of all, the American Health Care Act. Listeners, beware. Anything that calls itself American is probably full of shit. Two of the most misused words in the English language are American and freedom. If they call themselves the freedom something, grab onto your wallet because someone's about to reach into your pocket and grab it. Same thing really with American. Why do we have to call it the American Health Care Act? Are we confused that it might be some other country's Health Care Act? That's silly. Every other country has a workable, some form of single-payer healthcare system. We know, well, okay, I have to back up. I apologize. I suppose we do need to distinguish it from the Russian Health Care Act because, of course, there is a pretty legitimate concern that this act was drawn up in the same place that the Russian Health Care Acts are being drawn up. Other than that, do we really need to call it the American Health Care Act? And freedom. I know of one organization with freedom in the title that's actually a legitimate organization and basically not trying to pickpocket you. Other than that, the Freedom Caucus in the U.S. Congress, Freedom Works, and a whole lot more. What does freedom mean when it's in the title of an organization? You could probably bet that what freedom means is that somebody should be able to poison you and your family for profit. Someone should be able to engage in wage theft without being held responsible for it. Freedom tends to refer to wealthy people's ability to take even more of the world's wealth and put it into their own pockets by basically destroying the lives of everybody else. Freedom means I get to pollute your river, your air, all kinds of wonderful things. So already be cautious that we call it the American Healthcare Act. The other thing, though, that I want to take out of our discussions of the American Healthcare Act, something that we talked about last week, the concept of starve the beast, and how that's been a hallmark of Republican politics for at least a generation, probably a heck of a lot more than that. The concept of starve the beast is that the U.S. government doesn't have enough money to support programs for poor people, to continue funding education, road repair, or in local government's case, snow removal. In the federal government's case, emergency management. We don't have enough money for that. Sorry, we've been too busy looting the American government. It really serves two purposes here, this whole concept of starve the beast and how it works with the American Healthcare Act. First of all, as we talked about, a principled conservative wants smaller government. The principled conservative doesn't want to get rid of government, doesn't want to drown it in the bathtub, so to speak, as Grover Norquist famously said, but does want to reduce the size of government. Well, if you starve government of money, you do that. But we also talked about the fact that in 2017 and years previously, most of the Republican Party is really not about smaller government, it's about who government benefits. Republicans tend to be perfectly happy with big government as long as big government is giving money to oil companies and the people who run them. They're just not so big on government spending money on the average American. Well, how does the American Healthcare Act help support that ideal? Well, the American Healthcare Act drastically reduces taxes on the rich. It is a huge payoff to rich people, primarily balanced on the backs of everybody else. It is estimated that the top 0.1% in this country, people who are not exactly starving or close to starving, will benefit, on average, each individual about $200,000 because of the American Healthcare Act. Older people who might be concerned about whether they can afford health insurance will see their premiums going up dramatically. We don't have enough money to provide health care to poor people, to middle class people, to elderly people. We're too busy giving all that money to billionaires who obviously need more because it's time for you people to stop being so selfish. Do you understand how expensive it is to put fuel into a private 747? Do you understand that your 100-foot yacht is an embarrassment when all your friends have 110-foot yachts? We need to start understanding it from these people's point of view and how much they need the money. So the American Healthcare Act moves things to a large extent from the average American to the wealthy. According to the Congressional Budget Office estimate, 24 million Americans over time will lose their health insurance, and will once again get to play Russian roulette with their lives. Ah yes, the freedom to play Russian roulette with your life. Can't afford health care? Take a chance. Just hope that nothing serious goes wrong, because if something serious goes wrong, you're going to be dead. You have the freedom to be dead, to play Russian roulette. Isn't that nice? This whole concept of starve the beast is reflective of a major, bigger problem within our country. And that is the fact that we tend to think short term when we're clearly supposed to be thinking long term. You're not supposed to be thinking about making decisions that are good for your next year or two. You're supposed to be making decisions that are good for you way down the road. That's true of individuals, that's true of businesses, that's true of government. As individuals, you can understand why we tend to not do that as much as we should. The future is down the road. Many people don't have the luxury of making decisions to prepare for the future, saving money as we should be for retirement. If you're one of the majority of Americans living paycheck to paycheck, you don't have that luxury of thinking of the future. You just have the ability to think of getting through the day. We tend to not think about the future in part because the future is speculative. Whereas my hunger today, my desire for some cool toy today, is very real and very imminent. Government provides incentives for us to think longer term. We have IRAs, maybe pensions, which we get through businesses or the government, or things that give us an incentive to think longer term, to save for the future rather than spending the money now. But the biggest problems where we see short-term thinking rather than long-term thinking, and why this is such a tremendous problem for this country, is through the actions of businesses. Businesses, of course, and their leaders are supposed to be thinking long-term, not just the next few years, but what's in the interest of the business 20, 30, 40 years from now. There are all kinds of reasons why businesses tend not to do that. Too many businesses, at least, tend not to do that. Most of those having to do with the fact that the people running those businesses are not going to be running those businesses in 20, 30, or 40 years. Their stock options will vest. Their stocks will be sellable way before then. They will be stepping down as head of their businesses, maybe in a couple of years. It's at that point, perhaps, if that's when they can exercise stock options, or sometime shortly thereafter they'll be able to, if that's when they can start selling their perhaps millions of shares of stock, you don't have to worry about the future. Worry about where the stock price is on the day you can sell it. If your company has promised you 50 million shares of stock once you step down, if you can just lie, cheat, and steal and compromise the future of the company to raise that stock price by $3 a share, That's $150 million extra that goes into your pocket. For $150 million, we have a huge incentive not to think long term. For that kind of money, everyone would sell out. Years ago, in the wake of the financial crisis, I remember reading about how the acronym IBGYBG was floated around the financial community. IBGYBG apparently stands for I'll be gone, you'll be gone. And the way it was apparently being used, reportedly being used, was that someone in the financial community would be selling a product that everybody knew was toxic and was going to explode. It became a game of cosmic hot potato. So someone would say, wow, we're selling this derivative. These things are really junk, and this is going to end badly. And the response would be, IBGYBG. I'll be gone, you'll be gone. We're getting our bonuses in 2 months, then in 14 months again, and then 26 months. All this time, we can expect that the hot potato won't yet have exploded. When it finally explodes, someone else is going to be getting blamed for it or dealing with the consequences of it. I'm getting my bonus today. I don't have to worry about the fact that what I'm doing is going to destroy the future. Another entity that we need to be looking for the future for us is government. Government needs to think about the future, the long-term future, not the present, not the short-term future. And this problem is basically ours. That's right. The American voter doesn't give politicians an incentive to think long-term. Thinking long-term, for instance, generally requires that nasty term, taxes. As we know, the politician who uses the term taxes, or who says that he's going or she is going to raise your taxes, that's pretty much the end of that politician. We're not thoughtful enough to ask, well, what are the taxes going for? Am I getting my money's worth? As soon as we hear taxes, that's the end of the game. I'm put in mind of the 1984 presidential election between Walter Mondale and Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan's tax cuts and spending had created a huge budget deficit. And everyone in the country knew that taxes were going to have to go up. Walter Mondale, during a presidential debate, decided that he would level with the American public. He would treat the American public as if we were adults. Mondale said, "I'm going to raise your taxes if I'm elected. So is the other guy. The only difference is I'm telling you I'm going to do it." Well, the American public stopped listening at "I'm going to raise your taxes." And Mondale went on to be crushed in the election so that Ronald Reagan in 1986 passed the largest tax increase in U.S. history. Mondale was right. He was leveling with the American public, but there's no reason to do that. George Bush Sr., the better Bush, followed up with that, of course, with his famous "Read My Lips, No New Taxes" pledge during an election campaign where everybody knew the taxes were going to have to go up. It helped George Bush get elected, and he raised taxes. You have a huge incentive to lie to the American public because the American public tends to reward you for that. Any governor who wants to invest in his state may have to go to his people, her people, and say, "I'm going to ask for short-term sacrifice for the long-term good." Well, that governor is very unlikely to be rewarded for such a decision. This is why infrastructure is crumbling in America. This is why we do not invest in infrastructure as our competitors do. We're basically going to have our asses handed to us in the future. China's over the last few years has been averaging something like 9% of its economy on infrastructure spending. Europe somewhere between 5 and 6. America something in excess of 2%. Why? Think about it. You go to your constituents and you say, "I'm going to have to ask for short-term sacrifice in exchange for long-term good." You're not going to be the governor anymore by the time the projects are completed and the good starts filtering down. You'll have done something positive for one of your successors. Why would you do that if the American public isn't aware enough to reward you for that? So we tend to think very much in the short term. In a rare moment of honesty, President Boy George was asked during the Iraq War fiasco, "How do you see this ending? How do we get ourselves out of this?" And his response, "I don't know. That's going to be for the next guy to decide." In other words, I'm just leaving my problem to the next guy. It's not something for me to deal with. One of my depressing moments as a teacher in my many years of teaching, well, not that many, I don't want to age myself prematurely. One of my truly saddest moments, I had a student I knew very well, took me for 3 classes, we became good friends. Ultimately, she got married someone who was in the investment community, I'm guessing was making a lot of money, moved down to Florida and got enmeshed in a right-wing community. She called me up before the 2008 presidential election and said, "Well, you know, I'm in Florida. I'm in one of the few states that matter for a presidential election. Convince me why I should vote for Barack Obama and John McCain, and not John McCain." I wanted to respond, of course, by saying, "Sarah Palin? Sarah Palin? Do we need to go any further than that? This moron is a 70-something-year-old heartbeat away from the leadership of the free world? And the jackass who put her there, you're thinking of voting for? Even if he survives, his judgment is so called into question." But she continued before I had a chance to say that. And she said, "Tell me why my taxes will be lower under Obama than they will be under McCain." I wanted to respond by saying, how could you ask such an incredibly stupid question? Is the only question you ask before you go out to eat, what's the cheapest restaurant? Do you really eat at Taco Bell every single night? It's a little more complicated than that. Where's my money going? Is it being spent wisely? My taxes might go up $1,000. Would I be happy about that? Well, what am I getting for the money? As I say to my students, what about if CUNY tuition were free? Then would you pay the $1,000? Now they're all, yeah, because CUNY tuition is a lot more than that. Still a bargain, but a lot more than that. CUNY tuition would be free. How about free health care? Would you pay a couple of $1,000 a year for that? Sure you would. It's such a more complicated question, but this is evident. This is a bright, thoughtful, decent human being who basically all she needed to hear is taxes are going to go down. This is why we don't invest in our future, and this is why our future is in a lot of trouble. Also, very briefly, building on something that we talked about last week, I'd like to discuss the fact that the Republicans are already making noises about repealing Obama's rules regarding fuel efficiency of automobiles sold in America. Fuel efficiency requirements are supposed to go up in a few years. Like everything in America, before this policy was enacted, Obama went to the automobile companies and made sure that they were on board with this, that they could handle it, that they could do it, that they wouldn't put up too much of a stink to stop it. Because for bills to pass in America, you need the support of corporate America. And the automobile companies had said that those were numbers that they could reach a certain amount of time. You will be hearing Republicans say things like, it provides too much of a problem for automobile companies. They can't possibly reach these limits. To avoid making a mistake of listening to those arguments, you need to understand how our miles per gallon requirements works. We have in America something called fleet standards. And what that means is not every car sold by Toyota needs to meet the mile per hour, miles per gallon efficiency requirements. But as a whole, Toyota's entire fleet needs to. Well, that's kind of sad news a little bit, and kind of a Wizard of Oz moment of opening up the curtain for those of us who think that we're being socially responsible by buying Priuses or electric cars. While I'd like to believe that my buying hybrid cars is making the planet a cleaner and safer place, the fact is, because of fleet fuel requirements, what my buying a hybrid car is doing is allowing somebody else to buy a Ridgeline. Somebody who's not as socially responsible to buy a Toyota Tundra, a Honda Pilot. The car companies need to sell fuel-efficient vehicles so that they could sell the non-fuel-efficient vehicles, the socially irresponsible vehicles on which they make most of their money. I find that funny every time I feel the resentment from people driving big vehicles and seeing me driving around in a hybrid vehicle, and they're assuming that I think that I'm better than them. The only reason that many of them get to buy the vehicles they bought was because I bought the vehicle that I bought. Anyway, the mile per gallon requirements gives me an opportunity to follow up with something we talked about before, which is the concept of federalism or states' rights. Mile per gallon standards are set by the federal government under the Clean Air Act and other actual legislation. Generally, as we indicated last time, the nature of business is that businesses, by threatening to relocate and move, and of course threatening with their campaign donations, businesses can pit state against state, municipality against municipality, and intergovernmental bidding wars to give away the state treasury. We won't charge you taxes if you locate here because the neighboring state is already telling you that you won't have to pay any taxes if you locate there. We talked what that means last time, the race to the bottom and ultimately shifting the burden of running society, what a surprise, to poor people and to middle-class people, to people who aren't in a position, and to small businesses who are not in a position to extort that kind of stuff from the federal or state or local governments. Well, interestingly enough, when it comes to fuel efficiency standards and emission standards, there's one state in America that actually does have the ability to legislate. And that's California. California has such a large part of the overall national car market that if California institutes more stringent requirements on new vehicles, basically the rest of the country sort of needs to follow suit. Sometimes car companies can do a special fit where they could sell a particular car in California and sell it without a piece that makes it maybe cleaner elsewhere in the country, but for the most part, they're selling so many vehicles in California that if they have to make it to sell to the California market, they're making it the same way to sell to everybody else. So guess what happens? This is what's going to happen if and when the Republicans repeal the mile per gallon requirements negotiated by Obama. California is going to pass its own restrictions and make them serious. And the states' rights advocates, the people who supposedly believe in federalism, are going to scream something called preemption. California doesn't get to do that because the federal government gets to regulate fuel efficiency standards, not the states. Under current law, California has an exemption, a specific exemption under the Clean Air Act, to avoid that problem and to be able to legislate. You can expect that over the next few years, California will try to legislate, and our states' rights advocates and the federal government will scream preemption and tell California that it can't do that. What's at stake here? I lived in Los Angeles for several years while I was practicing law. And I have a couple stories to tell so you understand how this issue is going to affect you. You might know that the air in Los Angeles, because it sits in a basin surrounded by mountains and the smog tends to stay, the air is pretty polluted. My experience with this when I lived in California was twofold, at least twofold worth discussing. First of all, if you live in the East Coast, in the Northeast, you've probably had the experience that I have where you've taken your car to get washed, and then the next day it's rained, and you said, oh crap, I didn't need to wash my car. It rained. If I'd left my car out, the rain would have taken care of most of the car washing for me. That's not the way it works in Los Angeles. In Los Angeles, it works the exact opposite. If you take your car to a car wash and then it rains the next day, you say, oh crap, because you need to bring the car immediately back to the car wash. The air is so filled with smog and soot that when it rains, the raindrops bring down the fog, the smog, and the soot, so that at the end of the rain, your car is covered with black dots. This is what you're normally breathing in. The other part of that story that I wanted to share was I would come to New York to visit friends or family, and every time I came to New York, it would bother me that I got sick. I blamed it on the airplanes, which is probably pretty reasonable on my part to do. Airplanes do tend to spread viruses pretty well. But finally, after some time, I hate to admit how much time because I really should have caught on a little bit earlier, but after some time, it dawned on me what was happening. You may not think the air in New York City or Long Island is that clean, but apparently compared to Los Angeles, it is. Because what was happening is my lungs were busy cleaning themselves out. I was trying to cough out all the soot and the smoke and smog that had accumulated in my lungs. Yes, even in New York City. So keep paying attention to this one. Welcome to more dirty air. Welcome to exacerbated climate change. Welcome to more asthma among your children. For the last few minutes that we have today, I'd like to talk a little bit about American democracy. Donald Trump so famously tweeted a week or so ago that Obama was wiretapping him and was interfering with our sacred democracy. Let's talk for a few minutes about our democracy. First of all, the irony, as was noted last week, in a guy extolling the virtues of American democracy who lost the presidential election. Yes, I understand he won according to this thing called the Electoral College. But in a democracy, the people who get the most votes win. Donald Trump did not get the most votes. This is the second time, listener, in your lifetime, I'm willing to bet, that the loser of the presidential election, at least the loser of the popular vote, became the president. This should be very troubling. It should be troubling because it just so happens that those two losers of the presidential election who became president are almost certainly going to go down in history as the two worst presidents in the history of the United States. I realize it's early for Trump, but it's not that early. Right now, President Buchanan is turning over in his grave, going, yes, I'm number three. Pretty soon, a couple more Republican presidents and people are going to even forget that I existed. It's really not that funny, although I guess it is kind of funny. But we're saddled with these guys. But understand that if you get fewer votes for president and you still get to be the president, that's not democracy. This ridiculous concept of the Electoral College makes about as much sense as saying that the American presidential election is going to be determined only by the votes of guys named Maury. It makes no sense. Hey, I won the Maurys 9-7. I get to be president. Why do we have this stupidity? Who else has this stupidity? Nobody else has this stupidity. We've helped set up democracy in other countries. We've never set up an electoral college. Because it makes no sense. So why do we have it? Oh, that's a fun part of the story. We have an electoral college pretty much for two reasons. It's in the United States Constitution. One is to assuage slave owners and slave owning states. We give an extraordinary amount of power to people who own slaves, or we did when the Constitution was enacted. Hopefully we don't do that anymore because we have a 13th Amendment. We gave them tremendous power. In fact, their votes were worth more than the votes of people who were non-slave owners because their slaves counted when it came to electoral college votes, but they didn't get to vote, of course. Only their masters got to vote. A system that's in place to promote the interests of slave owners is one that in 2017 we might consider getting rid of. The other reason that we have the Electoral College, of course, is because the founders felt that the American public was probably too stupid to vote. And we needed a fail-safe mechanism in there in case they did something really, really, really stupid. You know, like elect Donald Trump. If the Electoral College was unable to correct this ridiculous mistake, then obviously that whole idea that it's going to stop the American public from making a stupid mistake like that is ridiculous. There's no reason to have this thing in the first place. I urge you to go to nationalpopularvote.com and register your vote to get rid of the Electoral College. It actually can be done. We might touch upon that in a future show. What is the impact of the Electoral College? Most states and the vast majority of voters mean absolutely nothing for presidential election purposes. Even where the states matter, people's votes aren't counted evenly. A vote, for instance, of someone in Wyoming is weighted tremendously more highly than someone in California, even if either of those states' electoral votes even mattered. The reason that most states don't matter, of course, is because, with two exceptions, all states are winner-take-all. Doesn't matter how much you win the state by, it just matters that you win the state. That being said, most states are irrelevant for presidential purposes because we know way in advance who's going to win the state: New York, California, Texas. Only one of the top largest states in America is up for grabs, and that's Florida. If California had an electoral vote for every 195,000 and change people, as does Wyoming, California would have 200 electoral votes, not the 55 it has. New York would have 101, not the 29 that it has. So not only does it make most voters irrelevant, even those voters who do vote and who might get counted get weighted very differently. Well, the Senate. We've got the Senate there. We're not going to spend a lot of time on the Senate. First of all, we're running out of time. The Senate wasn't intended to be Democratic. It's clearly not Democratic. Wyoming, with 500 and something thousand people, has two U.S. senators. California, with 39 million and change, also has two U.S. senators. Thus, once again, greatly expanding the power of the small states. So you can't talk about democracy in the United States Senate. When the Constitution was enacted, for many years thereafter, we didn't even have direct voting for senators. Clearly wasn't meant to be Democratic and isn't Democratic. Well, you've got the House of Representatives, the People's House, as it's referred to. That's the one where democracy is supposed to exist. Well, that's ridiculous. Out of 435 House seats, and by the way, listener, can you name who your congressperson is? The fact that you're probably slow to answer, even if you're able to answer, illustrates a little bit about how much democracy goes into even the People's House, the House of Representatives. The main problem with the House of Representatives is the concept of gerrymandering. And the fact is, out of those 435 House seats that are up for election every 2 years, probably didn't know that, but members of the House of Representatives serve two-year terms and are up for election every 2 years. Out of the 435 races, the 2016 race, it was expected by Ballotpedia that 23 of them would be contested in the general election. That's right, that's just over 5% would be contested in a general election. That's in large part due to the concept of gerrymandering. Gerrymandering, where legislative districts are drawn, not in any sense to create some kind of fair system, but where electoral districts are drawn by the party in power in the state to maximize its advantage within the state. If, for instance, you've got a state, let's say like Arizona, that has 10 House seats, and let's say that Arizona is roughly evenly divided between Democratic voters and Republican voters, one would expect that in an average year, 5 House seats would go to Democrats, 5 would go to Republicans. At a time when the Republicans are in particular disarray, some people would switch sides, and the Democrats would have a majority of the Arizona House. With gerrymandering, though, as several people have pointed out, in a democracy, voters choose their leaders. In America, politicians choose their voters. And so what happens is the state legislature of Arizona redraws congressional districts. Take a look at what some of them look like on an electoral map. They redraw congressional districts so that, let's say, as many Democrats as they could possibly fit go into 2 districts, thus leaving the other 8 districts with a huge Republican majority. What does that mean? There's almost nothing that will be happening in our society that will prevent that state from being 8-2 Republican in its congressional delegation. Not enough people switch sides, not enough people are informed to switch sides and say, even though I'm a registered Republican, I'm going to vote for the Democrat. So what happens is those 8 seats will all go to Republicans, 2 seats will go to Democrats, and everybody's sure of that. What impact does that have on you? Well, if you're a Republican congressman, unless perhaps you're in one of those 23 out of 435 competitive districts, the only chance you have of getting voted out of office is to lose in your primary, is to lose to another Republican in the primary. Who votes in congressional primaries? Usually crazy people, the most extremist of the extreme. And so what's happened is every Republican in Congress, basically, is not concerned about reaching out to the moderate middle to win a general election. They're concerned about guarding their right flank to protect against a Tea Party challenge, a Freedom Caucus challenge from their right. So even the ones that aren't crazy have to play crazy on TV. I talk about state and local elections, but since most of us don't even know who we're represented by on a state and local level, and since many of those run unopposed, there's really not a whole lot to talk about there. We may be proud of living in the world's foremost democracy, but we're not even living in a democracy. And that's before I talk about the misinformation that tricks voters, voter suppression, which we will talk about probably on our next show, and campaign funding. That's it for today's show. Thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoyed the show, our new streamlined version of Forward Nation Radio. We hope that you enjoyed it, and we look forward to seeing you next week. Remember to like us on Facebook, go to our website, forwardnationradio.com, listen to us on Podbean. What am I forgetting? We're involved in all social media. Please go to our website to look at everybody who's involved in this show. They're doing yeoman work. Thanks for joining us. See you next week.
You've been listening to Forward Nation Radio with David Leventhal.